Okay, I think we can continue now. So welcome to this week 5 second lecture in the banking course. Jari-Mikko gave you already in the morning the first session about regulation, and he will be continuing tomorrow. He had some technical problems there, but I hope that they didn't mind you too much. So we were able to get the recording also. And today the lecture will be given in Liikunta hall there in the main campus area. And some other things also here before I start talking about the monetary policy curves and other things here. I have now downloaded the instructions for the home assignments and also the material from that's available for you from Moodle. And next week, we have a change in the timetable. Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen had a double booking, so he will not be able to give actually live lectures at all. So he will be in Oulu on Wednesday and Thursday, so he will be giving a Zoom session on Friday. Actually, two separate Zoom sessions. So I will have the exact information about those sessions next Monday. And he will be then sending also the material for the lectures. So that part is also included to the exam. And parts of Olli-Pekka's discussion might be also relevant also for your home assignment too. But mostly that is more like out of interest, because he's going to be talking about sustainable banking, ideas of sustainable banking also. So please join, even though they are the very last sessions of the whole course and you have other things already going on, please join also our Zoom sessions. I will be hosting those on Friday and I will be following which are the students that are there also active. And about the exam, that will be a Moodle exam on 5th November. You will have plenty of time to do that during that day. I will give you more exact information about that in the last lecture of mine next week. So I will also give you the exact details about the articles that are required for the exam. Okay, so let's go back a few steps backwards regarding the discussions that we had last week. And I would like to remind you that even though we are seeing the actual things in the markets regarding monetary policy actions and sort of a steering of the real economic activity, we are seeing the things or the variables in terms of nominal quotations. So you basically don't have any idea, if you are not willing to calculate that yourself, what is the relevant real rate of interest, for example. And that is the main thing, actually, that you should be interested in. You get the nominal interest quotations from the markets. You get the nominal quotations for the prices and stock returns and so on. But you don't get anything real except the real production. But that's also originally given in real in nominal prices. But in theoretical terms, based on your optimizing behavior, you as a consumer or any other agent in the economy should be interested about real values, because the real things are the things that get you more utility and more profits and so on. So that is the reason why the central bank is giving the monetary policy curve, or it's considering the monetary policy actions based on this simple idea of the monetary policy curve. So it's considering the optimal level of real interest rate. So obviously it has to have an idea about the development of future inflation rates. It obviously has to have an idea about the current inflation rate, but also about the development of future inflation. That will be very relevant when we extend our discussions towards Phillips curve discussions at the very final lecture next week. But nevertheless, it's useful for you to get an idea already now about the main principles in the sort of a reaction function that the central banks even nowadays have. And this is still a valid representation for that reaction function, also in the forthcoming conditions of climate change, because the inflation reactions are going to be of extreme importance also in the future. Because we have to change our production, sort of ways of producing everything, basically. And there might be short-term shortages, about the supply of relevant things, like, for example, renewable energy-related metals, for example, they are really important in the future. So obviously, they might, for their part, induce pressures to the general inflation rate. So that is the reason why central banks still, in the future, will be focusing on inflation. And this monetary policy curve gives you a very, very sort of a simplified idea about how does the central bank react to inflation. The main thing for you to understand here is that, once again, we are considering real rate of interest. So you cannot get this from the markets. You have to calculate that. But you can get the nominal interest rates. So usually you get the value for the main steering rate of the central bank that it is using in nominal terms, and then have an idea about the relevant rate of inflation. Then the central bank has an idea about this R bar, that is the long-term equilibrium level of real interest rate. This guy here actually has now also changed after the global financial crisis. Before the global financial crisis, it was actually relevant to assume that this long-term real equilibrium real rate of interest was around 3% or 2%, around that. But basically, central banks were actually aiming towards a 2% level of inflation. So in nominal terms, the long-term equilibrium rate of nominal interest rates was around 5, perhaps. But it has changed. It's much, much lower now after the global financial crisis, because we have experienced these really, really low inflation periods in the Western economies, especially. The main thing for you to understand is that this parameter estimate, or this parameter, reaction parameter, lambda, has a positive sign. So basically, the real interest rate is assumed to be positively related to the development of inflation. So it measures the responsiveness of real interest rate to the inflation rate. Hence, we can say that the monetary policy curve is upward sloping. Real interest rates rise when the inflation rate rises. That's the main idea. So we can draw that now in a bit different context regarding the things that are relevant for economic agents. We are drawing that in terms of real interest rate and inflation rate, not real interest rate and production, like we did that in the case of the IS curve. So it's a bit different thing. In target variables, the central banks are focusing on inflation. That is the reason why we want to draw it like this. But we can combine these to the IS curve analysis and then sort of construct the aggregate demand curves based on those ideas. So the main thing for you to understand here is that you can get observation for inflation, you can get observations for nominal interest rate, and after that you can calculate, obviously, the real interest rates that would be reflecting the equilibrium condition in the monetary policy respects. In earlier textbook presentations, we were discussing about money supply or money market equilibrium. So this is loosely defined as a new concept regarding that. So the Taylor principle is the thing that is working here, and it will be working also in the future, because real economic activity is the thing that originally the central banks are supposed to be of really extremely interested about. But inflation is the actual thing that way they will, in a short-term development, also be focusing quite a lot. So to stabilize inflation, central banks must raise nominal interest rates by more than any rise in expected inflation. If they allow the real rate of interest to change equally much as is inflation changing, then basically it's not intervening at all. It's sort of allows the market mechanism to work as it does. So if the central bank allows real interest rate to fall when inflation increases, so this is based on the simple Fisher idea, of calculating the real rates of interest. So this is not the behavioral equation. This is based on the definition on how to calculate the real rate of interest. So you have to make a distinction between these two. When inflation rises, it causes ceteris paribus. If nothing else changes, the real rate of interest rate to go down. And that will have an effect, a boosting effect on the aggregate demand, because that's the relevant thing there in the IS curve analysis. And hence, that will also have an increasing effect on the inflation. So this, not necessarily a vicious circle, but circle anyway, starts to evolve. Things are feeding each other after this. Assuming that the central bank is not doing anything. If the central bank wants to cut this process, then it will be reacting to the change in the inflation rate. It will be increasing the nominal interest rate more than the inflation changes. So it will be having an effect on real rate of interest by its part. So that's the thing that you have to understand. So we have lots of things going on here with respect to the interest rates and inflation and so on. You just have to make a distinction between the things that are behavioral and those that are definitions. By definition, you can calculate the real rate of interest if you know nominal rate of interest and inflation or inflation expectations, then you are calculating ex ante real rate of interest. But in terms of behavioral equations, it's important to understand what is the behavioral relationship in the mind of central banker with respect to the inflation and real rate of interest. It's a bit different thing. Whether they want to have an effect on real interest rate or not, that's the key thing. Just remember that how do you calculate the things and how do you react as a central banker if you want to react. So if there is a shift in this monetary policy curve, there obviously can be two types of shifts. The first one is the so-called automatic stabilizer or automatic change, as reflected by the changes along the monetary policy curve. So in that case, as inflation changes, you can detect the change in the real interest rate based on the change in the inflation. So then autonomous changes that shift the monetary policy curve are the second possibility. So autonomous tightening of monetary policy shifts the monetary policy curve upward. At each and every point of that curve, we are assuming that lambda parameter is not changing. The value of the lambda parameter has a role to do in determining the slope of the monetary policy curve. We assume that it's not changing. So it's moving exactly the same amount at each and every point. And if there's an autonomous easing of monetary policy, that shifts the monetary policy curve downwards. And it stimulates the economy. So to put it really simply, you get more liquidity to the banking system, and that should be having a positive effect on real economic activity. Assuming that the banks are channeling the increased liquidity to the real economy, that they have not been doing to the degree that the central banks have assumed in the most recent years. But nevertheless, you can detect or have a sort of a graphical idea about these changes on what variables do they have an effect. So autonomous monetary policy tightening refers to the change upwards in the monetary policy curve, and autonomous easing in the monetary policy refers to the change downwards in the monetary policy curve. So basically, you can also In the other case, basically, the central bank is reacting perhaps in a new way to the current situation regarding inflation. If it wants to tighten monetary policy, it's seeing that the inflation is too high with respect to the target level. And if it's easing, it's also still focusing on the inflation rate. It's not perhaps enough, or it's not the thing that you should be worried about. At the moment, central banks are not too worried about the near-term development of inflation, but to my mind, they actually should be a bit more worried about this thing, because there are lots of liquidity bubbles that have been built up into the system, and they might be bursting now, that we are seeing various kind of frictions, for example, in the supply chains of the UK economy, that still might have an effect also to the European economy, for example. And we are seeing also the same things changing in the US economy. And the sort of a transmissions or spillovers from the US economy regarding the inflation rate towards the European economy might be really relevant in the near future. Some of the institutions, economic institutions, are not seeing it really they don't see too much signs about bad development in the near future with respect to the inflation rate, but I personally am a bit different. I have some kind of idea that there are going to be sort of a supply chain frictions also in the future in the US economy, and that really might have an effect on the European economy. That is the thing that we have to be worried about. So the interest rate might be actually increasing in the euro area also within shorter than 2 years period, actually, that most of the economists are now forecasting, at least in the banks, that interest rates will not be increasing for a period of 2 years. They might be wrong. It might not be the case. And these supply things are really important there. But nevertheless, you can be sure that if we get too high inflation pressures, the central bank will be reacting. And for those agents that have run into serious debt during the latest years of very loose monetary policy and negative interest rate, they might be in really serious troubles when we get positive quotations for the reference rates. But nevertheless, here we once again have this figure about the Fed funds rate and inflation rate. Whether they have been in connection, and indeed they have been in connection before 2008 crisis, but not after that. This is the simple message that you get from here. You remember that the Fed funds rate is the most important reference rate in the US markets, and it has pretty much lost its connection to the development of inflation rate after the 2008. So in this period after 2008, basically, the huge extensions in the balance sheets of central banks are playing the dominant role. That is the reason why, basically, the inflation rate has lost its connection to the main steering rate. It was pretty much zero until mid-2015, and it started to slowly increase until 2019, actually. We don't have that figures here, but we were around 2% level just in 2018 before the corona crisis and 2019. But you obviously know that after that, it collapsed. We have already drawn the figures for that. And it's still there quite low. So let's see what happens in the very near future when the Federal Reserve is going to be among the first banks, central banks, that will start withdrawing of these asset purchase programs. It will be the first one. It was the first one to start them, and it will be the first one also to withdraw them. So they will be having effect also on this, probably on this connection between the main standard conventional monetary policy tool or reference rate and inflation. They might be in more connection in the future. So, let's now move on towards the analysis of aggregate demand. We have now analyzed the separate components of aggregate demand in terms of the goods market equilibrium condition, the IS curve condition. That gives you an idea about the relationship between the interest rate and the amount of production or demand in these specific items. Aggregate demand is the thing that you have to actually draw with respect to the prices, inflation and quantity relationship. So it's not exactly the same thing, but you have to use these equilibrium conditions in the goods markets and in the monetary policy curve ideas, or in earlier days in textbook presentations, the money market equilibrium conditions to derive the idea in the aggregate demand, to get an idea about what are the effects or the change of events when a monetary policymaker does something with respect to enhancing the real economic activity. What is the chain of events that happens there? Or a fiscal policymaker changes something. Nowadays, like I have already mentioned many times, fiscal policy and monetary policy are too much sort of involved with each other, because the central banks have been buying the government bonds such a huge extent. So fiscal budget or the government budget deficits have been financed by central bank purchases. And that is the thing that sort of disturbs these ideas very much. We are not living a normal era of anything at the moment. But you have to once again remind yourself about these four components in the aggregate demand. So the first one is the private consumption expenditures. So this refers to the consumers' demand for goods and services. And then the second one is the planned investment spending. Planning is important here. So the second component here is actually already now forward-looking. So the relevant thing in terms of interest rates is the ex-ante real interest rate for these agents, for firms. How much do they have to pay for their funding in terms of real terms when they want to make more investments for real production purposes once again? So planning is really important. Planned total spending by business firms on new machines, factories, and so on, plus planned spending on new homes. This refers actually to the household sector once again, but clearly the biggest part here is played by the firm sector. Then the third item is the government purchases, spending by all levels of government, federal, state, and local on goods and services. And then the fourth part is the net exports. We have been discussing and analyzing, giving actually very simple functional forms for each of these aggregate demand components already. So you know already the main sort of variables that or factors that have an effect on these, all of these components. So by definition, we can define the aggregate demand in very simple representation to be given by this. So basically, if you are a central banker, you should have an idea about these things going on. What are the relevant variables that have an effect on private consumption, private investments, public consumption, and net exports? So it's nowadays actually the fact that in central banks, they have huge, really multiple equation models to model the behavior of all of these sectors. So nowadays, the central banks are using dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models. For example, at the Bank of Finland, they're using so-called AINO model, which is a DSGE model that has, I think that at the moment, it has something like 70 equations describing various relationships between the things that are actually included to this definition of aggregate demand. But in general terms, the thing that you would have to understand as a central banker is that if you want to have an effect on the price level, what is the chain or the effective channel through which your actions are being channeled to the real economic activity? So if you see a lowering tendency in the prices, so prices are coming down, you should understand that that will have an effect on the real cash balances. Because the real cash balances are the thing that you as a consumer have in your consumption function based on the Keynesian ideas. Real cash balances are important because you are using those for your purchasing purposes. This is the thing that, for example, the unions, labor market unions, are interested about in terms of what is the real purchasing power of your income and your cash balances and so on. So if it goes down, by definition, M per P goes up, assuming that the amount of M doesn't change immediately. So the central bank doesn't affect on the amount of money in the economy at the first step. It will be having an effect also on the nominal interest rate, I, and because it's a reference rate in the real investment behavior of the firms, it will be having an effect also on the real investments, uppercase I. So these guys are two different animals here. This is referring to the interest rate, and this is referring to the real investments. So ceteris paribus, assuming that the price change actually does not have pretty much anything to do, it's not changing enough so that it would have an effect on consumption at the private sector or expenditures at the public sector, or let alone their net exports, it will nevertheless, because it's having an interest rate effect, it'll be affecting on the real investment demand. So it will be having an effect, ceteris paribus, on the aggregate demand. It will be rising exactly the same amount as the real interest, real investments are changing. So it will be having an effect also on the net exports through the effects of changes in the interest rate on the exchange rate. So the exchange rate comes down, so your own currency gets to be devalued. So it gives you a competitive advantage to the international trade sector in your own country. So the net exports will increase. Assuming that nothing else once again happens there at the first step. So it will be having at least two effects. It will be affecting on real investments. It will be affecting on net exports through the effects on the interest rate. So the chain of events that you as a monetary policy decision maker have to have in your mind, that if there's some, for some reason or other, comes a exogenous type change in the prices. Like now we are experiencing fears of inflation increases that come from the energy sector, probably at the moment, because the energy prices seem to be rising all the time. For example, the price of electricity is really absurd at the moment in spot markets. That is really, it's three times the level last year at the moment. And the main reason is the very low range in the summertime. It will be having an effect on the prices, on the aggregate price level, on the inflation. So basically, it might be something that the central bank might be reacting, but unless that is a really, really big and more or less continuous effect, then probably, for example, ECB won't be reacting too much on this. But it's a really simple source for increasing inflation. Yeah.
I was thinking about the electricity or energy price increase, and isn't it kind of like a better thing that we know why price increases?
Yeah. Exactly. Gas
and the energy reforms and such. But also, I was thinking, isn't there probably like some kind of substitution effect in consuming when the electricity price increases? It's kind of like hedges of other consumers. So there might actually be some kind of deflation pressures.
Yeah, in terms of the other goods, you mean that because the purchasing power gets lower due to the rising level of prices in energy, it would lower also the possibilities to consume other goods. I was coming to that you have to always make a distinction if you want to go and analyze these in much more details, like the central banks are analyzing. For example, the consumption function is disaggregated to the normal goods, necessities, and luxuries, and so on. So you have these subgroupings for private consumption, and the price development in each and every item of those can be different. So it's really important to take also into account in a detailed analysis whether it's worth to sort of react to the pressure that comes to the general inflation rate based on the rising energy prices, whether it's worth to be reacted by the central bank or not. It might have these sort of side effects or negative effects on the demand of all the other components. So basically, to boost that or have that demand to be kept at the same level, then it would not be beneficial for the central bank in terms of the enhancing the aggregate economic activity to increase interest rate at all. And they are not willing to do that at the moment. The other thing, in addition to the analyzing these things with respect to the type of the consumption goods, are they necessities or are they normal goods or are they luxury goods, is the sort of a time dimension, the changes. We have now experienced a summer when, for example, the lumber or the any kind of timber products prices were huge. It was really the construction prices increased quite a lot in the summer. But now the factories have adapted to that. They have increased the supply. So it will be probably not having a permanent effect on the prices. And that's the other thing that you have to always consider. Are the effects that are shock type effects coming from some segment in the markets, are they permanent or are they just kind of a shock type short-term effects that will not permanently increase the core inflation, for example? That's a really, really relevant question. But nevertheless, as a central banker, you have to consider these things. Are you willing to react to changes in the markets or not? What will happen to the other sectors if you react to the prices in the energy sector, for example, for the sake of stabilizing the inflation? That's actually why one of the reasons why in the summer, in July, ECB actually announced this change in the framework of monetary policy. They are not so tightly focusing only on the 2% level and want to maintain that core inflation below 2%. They are now allowing also the possibility that in short-term development, inflation might be higher than 2%. And it's equally bad compared to the situation when it's below the 2% level at the same amount. So they are actually increasing. And there have been actually discussions about this relevance of this fixed inflation target, whether it's really relevant or not. Should it be adaptive, actually? Should it be now reacting to the changes in the production possibilities and changes in the green transition, for example? Because it will be, for sure, it will be inducing much more price variability. Uncertainty regarding the development of general prices will be increasing due to green transition quite a lot. It's a really nice paper, that occasional paper by ECB. Even though it's a long paper, 200 pages, take a look at that. It really pays attention to these things. But they are not still textbook things. They are just suggestions for the sophisticated set of big amount of economists within the ECB group that they are figuring out whether what are the changes that will be coming through this green transition and other things, climate changes. Okay, but nevertheless, you should go back to the basics at each time when you consider these things, and this is still the basic equation or basic definition that you should be able to sort of utilize in your more complicated analysis too. So the fact that the aggregate demand curve is downward sloping can be derived from the quantity theory of money. Actually, we did that actually also, but there's this problematic assumption of velocity. It's not actually good to have this assumption about this constant velocity. So it's not perhaps a really relevant thing to be used as an approach to analyze aggregate demand development. But the other thing that is, there's a typo actually, it's autonomous. What is the meaning of this autonomous? It means that in each and every part of the aggregate demand function, consumption, investments, public expenditures or public consumption and net exports, there are parts that are not depending on the main important variable that has an effect on that. So there are these exogenous things, like, for example, for investment behavior, frictions in the financial markets are important. If you get more frictions due to the possible collapses, for example, stock markets, it has an effect on the indicators reflecting the uncertainty of investment behavior. So purchasing indexes, for example, are the thing that are being used there to reflect the uncertainty development. So the aggregate demand in general terms gives you an idea about the inflation rate, relationship between inflation rate and aggregate demand when the goods markets are in equilibrium. So we are not now anymore drawing these things with respect to the interest rate. We have the price level change, we have the inflation rate there now. And it's central to aggregate demand and supply analysis because it sort of gives you a possibility to explain also the cyclical fluctuation, short-term fluctuation in aggregate output and inflation. So for example, at the quarterly level of observations or annual level of observations. So we are talking about short-term cyclical variations. So basically it's derived from the ideas at the background of monetary policy curve nowadays and the IS curve that is reflecting the commodity or the goods markets equilibrium. And the aggregate demand curve has a downward sloping curve. As inflation rises, the real interest rate rises, so that spending and equilibrium aggregate output fall. So you should obviously at this point analyze this as not a direct relationship between prices or price changes and output, even though it is only from microeconomic point of view, it is actually understandable that the higher are the prices or the higher is the change in the prices, the lower are you willing to demand. If you are discussing about the demand of an individual agent at the microeconomic level, this is the thing that you get to be introduced to with the very principles of microeconomics courses, or at least at the intermediate level. But here, when we discuss about macro things and we discuss about the role of monetary policy, we have to understand that it actually is being channeled through the effects on the interest rates. Interest rates are not there in your diagram at all, but they are playing a strong role behind of the behavior. So you draw this with risk with prices or changes in the prices, i.e. inflation and real economic activity. But the thing that has an effect there in these changing conditions is the interest rate. That is the thing. And it's a relevant factor both in the monetary policy curve and in the IS curve. So that's the reasoning. That's the simple reasoning why you want to do this analysis like this. So basically, you can derive the aggregate demand curve through these equilibrium conditions in the money market. So here you have the real interest rate and the inflation rate in your axis definitions. And here you have the real interest rate and the aggregate output in the case of IS curve. So they are different. But nevertheless, through these indirect sort of a change of effects that you get when you analyze the effects in the changes, for example, of real interest rate or inflation on the economic agents' behavior, individual agents or sectors in the economy. So you get this to this idea that it's the interest rate that has a role to do there. Hence, at the background of this downward sloping aggregate demand curve are the assumptions about how does the central bank react in terms of changing the interest rate with respect to the inflation. How do the consumers, or first of all, the investors, which means the real investors, the firm sector, and net export part of the aggregate demand, how do they react to the changes in the real interest rate? So that gives you an idea about how to draw this final thing. That is intuitively actually quite, it should be reminding you of the very simple ideas in microeconomic behavior of all the agents with respect to the demand. Price is relevant, quantity is relevant, quantity is lower when price is higher, quantity is higher when price is lower. But it's not exactly the same thing here, because you have to consider the things that are relevant for decisions of the individual components in the aggregate demand, CI, G, and NX. So it's not exactly the same thing, but basically, you should understand that it goes like this. This is actually intuitively understandable. It's actually relevant to do this analysis using this. So you have to be able to discuss separately the effects of changes in all of the factors that have a role to play in determining, first of all, the commodity market or the goods market. I nowadays want to discuss about commodities because commodities are the real things. But the IS curve actually includes also the services demand. So it's not exactly the same thing as the commodities, but goods markets in general. Goods can be real goods or services, but nevertheless, the demand that you can use for to meet your needs in terms of consumption. So autonomous consumption expenditure is the thing that is not reacting to the relevant thing, that is the real interest rate there at all, disposable income. Disposable income is the first thing there. In the Keynesian liquidity preference analysis, we also have the interest rate, but autonomous part is not reacting to either of these. It's more like a sentiment thing or confidence thing. The higher is the consumer confidence, the bigger is the consumption, and vice versa. Autonomous investment spending is also something that is related to the sentiments of the investment sector or the real investors, the firm sector. Government purchases are also something that might have an autonomous part that is not related to the income, the level of aggregate income in the economy at all. And taxes are the thing that can change. They are completely exogenous to other agents. So if a government decides to tax you more, they can do that. It will have an effect on your consumption also. And then the autonomous net experts are the thing that also have an effect. So they are the part that's not dependent on the interest rate. Once again, they can be related to something like the foreign customers, confidence indexes and so on, or the general indexes at the global trade, and also regarding the uncertainty indexes, for example, at the general level. But they are, the main thing is that they are not dependent on the development of interest rate at all. Exogenous type shocks. And any factor that shifts the IS curve shifts the aggregate demand curve in the same direction. I have actually written a paper about the Finnish GDP development with respect to these autonomous things that we were measuring with some of my PhD students using these uncertainty indexes. It's not published in English. It's in the Kansantalouden Aikakauskirja, a Finnish Journal of Economics. So you probably cannot get the idea of that, but you can ask your Finnish friend to translate that to you if you want to take a look at. But nevertheless, main message in our analysis is when we compare the effect of uncertainty measures, global or European or US economic policy and indexes, how do they affect the Swedish and Finnish GDP components? We got the result that the Finnish investments are really dependent on these uncertainty indexes quite a lot. So nowadays you can have a measurable set of observations for these things. So you can measure these autonomous parts also in empirical terms. It's not just the thing that it's not dependent on interest rates. It's something that you can measure. Uncertainty related to everything is now playing a big role. We have lots of various forms of uncertainties that are increasing at the moment at the global level. So they are constituting these autonomous parts actually in this GDP definition. Nevertheless, any factor that has an effect on the IS curve, it will shift the curve and hence the aggregate demand curve in the same direction. Either come down or go up. So it will be having an effect also on the aggregate demand. So here we have an idea about, for example, changes in the government purchases. So obviously when government purchases change, they should originally not be in the monetary policy curve. Nowadays, they are there, but it's really difficult to say that which part of the government expenditure changes has been exactly financed by the central banks through their purchase programs, asset purchase programs, because they are secondary buyings. They are buying those from the banks. So they are not sort of earmarked in that way, that this part of the deficit that has increased in the Finnish government budget has been financed by the purchase of the Bank of Finland. You cannot do that, actually. And that's one of the reasons why we would very much like to get rid of this thing now, because it's really disturbing in terms of analyzing the effects of changes in the goods markets with respect to the demand curve. So, but if we assume that there's a rise in government purchases, it will have an effect on the equilibrium output, so it will shift the IS curve rightwards. So the equilibrium amount of output increases, ceteris paribus, assuming also that the central bank is not doing anything. So basically, it will be having an effect on the aggregate demand also through that. So the second thing that might happen might be the change in the monetary policy curve, if the central bank decides to do something. Autonomous tightening of monetary policy means a change in the real interest rate at any given level of inflation. And it shifts the aggregate demand curve to the left. There's an effect on the, especially on the investment sector or the firm sector that is doing real investments, and also on the net exports. An autonomous easing of monetary policy shifts the aggregate demand curve to the right. So equally same kind of chain of events happens here, but we now assume that there's no change in the position of IS curve. So we get to a new equilibrium situation where all the things that have been assumed to be happening by the reactions of the firm sector to the tightening of the monetary policy have been channeled through to the real economy. So there's a decrease in the production or the aggregate output, and with the target inflation level of 2%. Here we have drawn this figure based on the current mostly used target level of 2% for the modern economies. So this is holding also actually at the moment at the ECB level. There's the target level for inflation is 2%. So the thing that happens here is here in the first left-hand side panel here. So there is a tightening autonomous change in the monetary policy that increases the real interest rate. You have to remember which are the items that are being affected by the changes in the real interest rate and how. You cannot see it through here immediately, just bear in mind, yeah, okay, real investments, they go lower if the real interest rate increases because it's more expensive to finance your real investments. So the demand for investments will decrease. Ceteris paribus, assuming that it doesn't even have an effect on the net exports at all, it will be lowering the aggregate demand. There's this ceteris paribus, or assuming everything else being left untouched. So if there is a leftward shift in the aggregate demand curve, the chain of events can be caused, or the change in this position can be caused by all these things here. So if the real interest rate, autonomous real interest rate increases, autonomous part of consumption lowers by the public sector, lowers, taxes increase. So the autonomous part of taxes increases. So net income of the household sector decreases, ceteris paribus once again. Net exports get lower. You cannot analyze these simultaneously because you have no idea basically about the time frequency or time sequence of these things, if there comes a change in the public expenditures, for example, what is the relevant time sequence during which the other things start to happen? You have no idea about that. You can estimate based on data, basically, these reaction times, but it's really difficult to do. So you have to assume that if nothing else changes. So if autonomous partner consumption goes down, then aggregate demand will shift to the left. And also if autonomous partner investments goes down, then the same thing happens. If here, the final component here refers to the financial frictions. And for that, the definition is that the higher is the value of F, the more there are frictions. At the moment, we have experienced now once again that the stock markets have started to come down. So basically, that might give a reason for increasing levels of financial frictions in the future if they keep on going down, and that those problems in the Chinese real estate sector start to realize to the other markets also, then it might be increasing the financial frictions. But nevertheless, we still have these unconventional monetary policy actions that the central banks can do, and they for sure will be doing that because it has proven to be an efficient tool in hindering or sort of decreasing the level or the effects of financial frictions. But nevertheless, the things here that can affect the position of aggregate demand curve are listed here. They are all coming from the specifications for the aggregate demand definition and the behavioral equations behind those individual components there. So vice versa, if there's a counter change there, or there's a vice versa change in the signs of the changes in these relevant variables, then the change will be towards right in terms of the aggregate demand curve. But remember that we are now drawing this in terms of inflation and aggregate output, not anymore in terms of the interest rate, even though the main relevant thing for most parts of this is still the interest rate. But we are now discussing about autonomous components. So this refers to the bar, using this bar identifier there. So we are discussing about things that are not actually related to the interest rates at all. In addition, interest rates may change. So then we are moving along the IS curve, for example, and it will also have an effect on the position of the aggregate demand. But these are the autonomous components. So these are the shock type things. And nowadays we can have sort of a time series data for these things that are relevant also in all these components of the aggregate demand curve. So basically, the factors that shift the aggregate demand curve are here listed here. So there's an increase in the money supply. If there's an increase in the money supply, it shifts to aggregate demand curve to the right. Holding velocity constant, an increase in the money supply increases the quantity of aggregate demand at each price level. Increase in spending from any of the components will also shift the aggregate demand curve to the right. So let's go and analyze now the other part. We have a full understanding about the components of the aggregate demand and how you can sort of have an effect as a policymaker on those. The only problem nowadays is that it's really difficult to make a distinction between these policymakers because monetary policies and fiscal policies are sort of mixed at the moment. Let's hope that we can get rid of that situation in the near future. But the other part here is obviously the supply. What are the relevant things that have an effect on the supply of things in the markets, in the economy? And here it's really important in terms of this cyclical analysis or the policy analysis to make a distinction between the long-term and short-term things. Main idea there is that when you are discussing about long-run possibilities to increase your supply, you are discussing about the actual amounts of capital and labor, and most importantly, the productivity of your inputs, technical technology or the production technologies. And they develop. Their development over time is the most important things in terms of economic growth. So we are discussing about the proponents of the economic growth here, and we are discussing about the determinants that determine the aggregate supply in the long run. And it's by definition, it's a vertical line at the natural rate of output generated by the natural rate of unemployment. What is this natural? Natural is the thing where basically all the productive inputs are in full use. It doesn't mean a situation where unemployment is zero, but all that wish to have work, they are working. So there's only kind of a structural unemployment in the economy, and all the labor force or all the labor market participants that want to work get a job. That's the simple idea. Also, the rate of inflation would be at the natural level. That's a long-term equilibrium level for inflation. There's no need for changes in that because the labor markets are in equilibrium at that point. There's no excess demand for labor, or there's no excess supply of the labor. So there's no pressure for the wages, and hence for this part, there's also no pressure for the inflation that would come from the labor market. But when we go to the discussion of the short-term things, we skip this thing, actually, because we have to admit that wages and hence the prices, aggregate prices, are sticky. They cannot adapt to the changing conditions with respect to the demand and supply immediately. It takes time. Labor market agreements are for some years. There are lots of discussions now going on about the local agreements regarding wages. And that is actually the main idea there, is actually to enhance the possibilities of the economies to go towards more like natural levels of everything. But it's more or less an impossibility to do this really swiftly or really, really fast. So we have to admit that there are lots of reasons. Labor market unions are not the least, they are not the smallest reason for that, but we have to admit that wages and prices are rigid. So they are sticky. They don't change immediately, or they even don't change within 1 year necessarily. So this gives you an idea that there has to be a other kind of short-run aggregate supply curve that is not actually a vertical line. It's a upward sloping curve. So it has a positive curvature. It has a positive slope. So it attempts to take advantage of short-term profitability when price level rises. So it gives also the possibility for the firm's sector to get excess returns or excess profits from the short-term changes in prices, positive changes in prices. So they can they try to sort of reformulate their production so that they can meet the aggregate demand increases in the future. This is the thing that actually happened in the construction equipment market this summer in Finland. Firms were able to get excess returns or excess profits based on increasing prices, but then the supply started to suffer from that. So they had to increase the supply, recruit more people to work on the sawmills and so on. So if we draw these figures, relevant figures, to the same picture, we have this long-run aggregate supply curve. We draw it once again using the same axis as we are using for the aggregate demand. So inflation on the y-axis and production or the aggregate output at the x-axis. And we assume also that it's really relevant actually to allow for the possibility that the prices and wages, or wages and prices, are not completely flexible in short term. So that mainly gives you the reason for drawing the aggregate supply curve in the short term to be something that's a upward sloping curve. So the higher is inflation, the more there's output. Positive correlation between output and inflation. So the higher is the demand, we're assuming here that the inflation pressure comes from the demand side actually there. So it's profitable to produce more when prices increase. Well, you can actually sell the same amount of production with higher prices, so you get more returns. It's really simple, simplistic idea with this respect. So the relevant thing here is to analyze the what are the things that have an effect on the positioning of these aggregate supply curves. So first, let's take a look at the long run curve that originally, or that vertical curve. So if there is a change in the position of that, then it can come from the changes in the total amount of capital or total amount of labor or productivity of those. Available technology or decline in the natural rate of unemployment. If there's a rightward shift. So each and at each and every inflation level, you are able to produce more in long term. So obviously, this is actually something that is of relevance to the policymakers nowadays. This is the reason why they want to enhance the productivity in the economy, because the central banks have fixed the inflation target. Is it really possible? If you have a fixed inflation target, then it's most probable that if you are doing other policy things to enhance real economic activity, then the central bank would be wiping out those, because they have, if they risk, your actions risk the development of prices at the inflation level. Central bank would be wiping out those actions, actually, basically. So this is actually giving you an idea that why is it so relevant? Why, for example, Mikael Valiranta, who is a part-time professor in Jyväskylä, he always talks about the productivity effects, this creative disruption, is his sort of a favorite child that he wants to emphasize in the public discussions. It's based on this idea that now we have actually this thing that the central banks have announced. They have targeted a permanent level of 2% for the inflation. How can we enhance real economic activity in any other way than just enhancing the long-term productivity of this capital and labor? Capital and labor are nowadays increasing not so much as they did in early times. So it's most part of the increases in the production have to come from the increases in technology or productivity of these inputs. So if there's an opposite movement, the other side movement, the other way around in these variables, it shifts the long run aggregate supply curve to the left. So basically, you should understand this now clearly. Productivity is one of the main things that has an effect on the position of the long-run aggregate supply. What about the short-run thing? What are the things that have a role to play there? There are three factors, basically. The first one is the expected inflation. Why expected inflation is relevant? Why not inflation? Why does it have to be expected inflation and not the actual inflation that is the most relevant thing here? Can you give me any idea? Why price shocks? Why persistent output gaps?
Yeah. Sorry, can we consider expected inflation as kind of shock or something we are taking consideration, we are ready, we make all preparations, but it doesn't actually occur. But because we are always ready, we this is kind of
So you're sort of discussing that the expected inflation is having also an effect on the inflation, actual inflation. So the sort of expectations start to feed themselves.
Yes.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons. Well, price shocks might actually be something we have already been discussing, that these price, individual price shocks, like from the energy markets, they might be relevant actually. And then persistent output gap. So this is not related to inflation. What are, where do you have all these guys? In terms of the policymakers' functions, target functions, where do you have all these three guys? They are belonging to the Taylor rule, so the central banks actually are focusing on these things quite a lot. And it's relevant to think that, for example, expected inflation, obviously it should have an effect on the expected real rate of interest, and that's a relevant thing having an effect on the firm side investments, real investments. So expected inflation is something that is a bit worrying if it starts to feed up. You were right in that, that if there's a danger that the expected inflation, increasing expected inflation, starts to get feed up in the actual inflation. So the inflation shocks, expected inflation shocks, turn out to be permanent. So they are having an effect on the inflation. We will be discussing in more details about this, details about this in the Phillips curve discussions next week at the final lecture. Price shocks are also the things that the central banks focus quite a lot, because they want to stabilize the development of prices. So they want to stabilize the inflation rate. Price shocks are the things that they are really focusing quite a lot. And they have also an effect on the supply. If the price shocks come mainly from the demand side and they are very short term, it's not profitable for the firms actually even to increase their production, because they cannot sell that probably in the future when the investments get ready. They are not able to sell anymore at the higher price. So price shocks, you have to be able to analyze whether they are permanent or whether they are really short term. They are really shocks. And then the persistent output gap. Persistent output gap, once again. The time dimension or the time sort of a scheme here is really important. Are the output gaps persistent or not? Or are they more like kind of a cyclical changes in the production that are reacting to other things in the economy? So there are these three factors that can have an effect. And they will change the position. So basically, if there's an increase in expected inflation, it will shift the supply curve to the right. If there's an inflation shock positive, shift the supply curve to the left, because it will might have an effect on the actual inflation. So at each and every level of production, the inflation would be higher in the future. The second thing, inflation shock, especially if it's a permanent one, not a sort of a contemporary, very short-term inflation shock, it might realize into a situation that it also changes the position of the aggregate supply towards left or up. And then persistent output gap is the thing. The output gap is also a thing that the central bank is having in its focus, in its Taylor rule. So basically, if there's a permanent change in the output gap, it is in connection to the excess demand, continuous excess demand in the at the aggregate level of economy. So it will be having an effect on inflation. So here we show only these positive changes in the factors that have an effect, but obviously if they go down, they will have an opposite effect also on the position of the supply curve. So let's go and dig deeper, dig a bit deeper on these individual components regarding these factors that change the position of the aggregate supply curve. So first one is this change in the expected inflation rate. So if inflation expectations increase, they might have an effect on the actual inflation also, if they start to be feeding the actual inflation. So they are sort of a realistic changes in the expected inflation. Big question at the moment is that, are these changes, for example, in the energy sector, are they affecting or price pressures in the energy sector? Will they be affecting at the aggregate level of inflation more or less? Remember that the energy prices and housing prices are an important component there when we sort of calculate the core inflation. But nowadays, central banks, even the ECB, is not focusing so much anymore in separating the effect of energy prices from the actual inflation rate or the consumer prices development, because the energy sector plays such a huge role in everything nowadays. It's not just out of interest that, well, the prices are now for some reason or other higher than usually, but the increases in the prices might be permanent. So it's not actually really relevant to sort of extract the effects of energy prices from the general consumer prices, because they have started to play a bigger role nowadays in inflation at the aggregate level. So if this expected inflation shock sort of stems out from the changes in the energy prices and they start to feed up themselves, so it might actually result in a situation where the actual inflation increases. Here we are now assuming that central bank is not willing to react to this, so it allows actually the inflation rate to increase. And we had a nice discussion about this. What is the effect on the other items in terms of the purchasing power of the consumers? So if there is a change, the second possibility is a change in the output gap. So if there's a persistent positive increase or a positive change in the output gap, then it leads to an increased inflation, basically, because we are moving along this line in the first step. We are here in the first step. So it will be causing a movement from point one to point two in the original aggregate supply curve. But what is the thing that next happens here? Who is the economic agent, or what is the sector that realizes that there is a change in the output gap that seems to be positive? It has an effect on inflation. It has increased inflation. So is it profitable for the firms to start producing more or not? They can sell their current production with the higher prices, so actually it is more profitable. So the aggregate supply curve might start to be reacting towards. It might start to change its position. So persistent, assuming that it is persistent. That's the main thing here. You have to assume that the change in the demand is persistent. So there's a positive output gap and it increases expected inflation, and that shifts to the changes in the inflation like we saw in the previous slide, and it shifts the aggregate supply curve on and on until we get to a situation where the aggregate output actually returns to the position level with higher prices, the original level with higher prices. So the economy has sort of adapted to the changing in the original situation. Everything just gets to be sold with higher prices. So inflation rate is higher. Production is at the original level, its potential level. Notice that this means that the production is higher or the demand is higher than is the potential level. So there's excess demand. output gap, positive output gap, refers to the situation where there's excess demand in the economy. So it's profitable for the firms to sell more. There's excess demand and increase prices start to increase. It's not possible to increase the production because you originally were at the potential level of production. Somehow you would have to get more labor force like, for example, immigrants. In the case of Finnish economy, you have to get more immigrants, more capital, more productivity to be able to increase your potential level of production. So the thing that starts to adapt here is the prices, inflation level. So it will be, at the end of the day, it will, the production, the amount of aggregated output will return to the potential level. And all that happens in the economy are the increasing prices. Inflation rate has increased. This is a really big sort of a kind of a reflective change in the inflation. Usually, for example, in the in the European economies, we will probably not be seeing anything like this because the banks, the central banks are going to be active in terms of trying to prohibit this development, actually. But if you don't do anything, this starts to go on. And so the central bankers are interested about the equilibrium, especially. So for that, we have to put the aggregate demand and aggregate supply curve to the same figure. And it's now describing their interconnection or their connection point. Interaction point is describing the general equilibrium in the economy. So in that point, all the markets that are relevant here are simultaneously in equilibrium, and the quantity of aggregate output is demanded is equally the same as the supply of aggregate output. So that's the general idea. So in short run, you can detect, we have drawn this now for the sake of curiosity, to be reflecting the currently observed or accepted target levels for inflation. So inflation rate is at the 2% level. That is the relevant level nowadays, for example, in ECB and also actually in the Federal Reserve, even though they are talking about increasing that level. But nevertheless, in equilibrium point, you have certain amount of production at the aggregate level from the economy. So if there is a change in the something that has an effect on this positioning, so for example, a change in the wages. So assume that as a background for this, there might be a case that we are experiencing a really positive situation in the business conditions. So there's a, there's the original situation is that aggregate demand is above the potential level, actually here. So aggregate demand is being noted here from this aggregate demand curve, and the short-term aggregate supply is here, and the potential level is here. So it's 10. And now we actually observe a situation under really positive business situation, so really active situation, we have an excess demand situation in the markets. So it will have an effect on the production needs and costs, because there's obviously a need to meet that demand. So there will be an increasing demand for labor. So it will be having an effect on the wages. So this excess tightness in the labor markets refers to the need to recruit more people to do the production, and you are only able to do that with based on increasing the wage, because originally you are at the equilibrium here, basically in long run terms. So there's an excess tightness in the labor market, and it will increase the expected inflation, because the wages start to increase, it will obviously have an effect on the inflation, and it will shift the aggregate supply curve upwards until we get to a situation that we actually return back to the potential level. So the only thing that happens here is the increase in the inflation level. Assuming that the policymakers are not willing to do anything here. So the thing that happens in the new market, here we assume that the market are allowed to do their thing. So they start to adapt both in the labor markets and in the production. So the firms increase the production, but they need to hire more people to do the production. So it will be ending to a situation where the inflation has increased, but production has regained its potential level. The other way around, when we start from the situation that refers to kind of a recession or bad situation in terms of general economic activity, so that short-run equilibrium is below the potential output. So there's no need to use all the labor force. So there's unemployment, basically. So this excess slack in labor market, it refers to the situation that you don't need all the people that are supplying their labor input for the production purposes. So there's unemployment. So it will decrease the expected inflation. There's no need to increase wages. So there's actually pressure to lower wages to be able to recruit all the people that are willing to come to work. So there's an effect also on the inflation. It will start shifting the aggregate supply curve downwards until we get to a situation where we are able to get to the potential production level. So we are starting originally from here. Point one, there's unemployment. There's need to lower wages to get the people to be recruited or working. And it will have an effect also on the potential output after that. So the prices will go down. This is a really simple sort of a idea about the connections behind or the things that happen there behind this adaptation process with respect to inflation and aggregate output. But this is the thing that actually starts to get working. The thing there is that there are big differences in terms of the time dimension. How long does it take to get back to the equilibrium in both of these cases? And it's very much dependent on the structure of the labor markets. How powerful are the labor market institutions in that individual economy? Or are the labor markets more like market-based? In the US case, actually, these sort of adaptation processes can take actually fairly short time compared to, for example, Nordic countries. But the thing that happens here can be described based on this. So basically, we can talk about these self-correcting mechanisms. Regardless of where we originally are in terms of this positioning of the production or equilibrium point, we eventually go to the natural rate if the markets are allowed to work like the markets should, based on the optimizing ideas. So we may have slow adaptation or slow transition process or rapid transition process. In the slow process, wages are not flexible. They are especially not flexible downwards. We see this actually very well in Finland. It's not possible. Basically, you cannot lower the wages of any of your... actually, it has been observed now in some firms that where you are able to do these firm-level agreements. People are willing to accept lower wages for a period of time if they are being promised the return back to the same level of wages when the things start easing up a bit. We have, I don't want to mention the names, but you have read this from the public media, actually, that there are some firms in Finland. Well, one of those is Ponsse, actually, for example, that are really good in this. And their labor, working force is really, their staff is really happy. They are really enjoying working in that firm. But they have these firm level agreements. So it's actually something that can happen to a degree. But I have no idea about the general coverage of those. I have heard news about individual firms that have been able to do that. Obviously, the unions are not happy about these things. They don't want these kind of things to be taking place. But it is actually something that refers to the power of the markets to do their things. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. If we have these slow mechanism, there's obviously need for active government policies. If we have a rapid system, there's less need for that. So if it's more like a US-type market-based adaptation process in the labor markets, there's no big role for the government interventions actually at all. People might be, in general terms, more satisfied for these things because wages and prices are flexible, so they react to the general economic conditions. When it's going well, wages increase. When it's going not so well, wages are lowering, and people accept that unless they go unemployed. That's the main thing. To stay working, that's the main thing. Okay, so if there are changes in this equilibrium, they can come from these aggregate demand shock changes, for example. So now that we are able to understand the distinction between short run and long run things in terms of the equilibrium, we can actually discuss about the things that happen when there are demand shocks, shocks that cause the aggregate demand curve to shift. So if there's a positive demand shock, it means that for some reason or other, there might be a change in the autonomous consumption, positive change in the autonomous consumption, positive change in the autonomous investments, positive change in the public expenditures, positive change in the autonomous part of net exports, and then, for example, easing of monetary policy or lowering of taxes. Any of these things might sort of cause this thing to happen. All these have a positive effect on the position of the aggregate demand curve, so it shifts to the right. So here we are originally, and we always want to draw this potential production curve, also this long-run aggregate supply. So here we are originally, something positive happens, and it changes the position of the aggregate demand curve. Production increases, but also inflation increases. And after that, the firm sector realizes that there's more possibilities to produce or at least sell at the higher prices because the inflation has increased. They will increase the production, actually. So then aggregate supply curve also shifts. It will go to this position of AS3. And then if it continues, the chain of events continues until the economy returns to the long-run equilibrium with inflation permanently higher. So there's no change in the potential factors of potential production here. So this is very much a cyclical change, short-term change in aggregate demand. And what are the effects of that with respect to the changes in production in short term and inflation? This can, depending on the economy, these things, we are assuming that nothing, the original shock doesn't cause anything else to change during this adaptation process. So there are some economies where the time horizon for this full effect is actually quite short, but it depends quite a lot on the market situation or especially the situation with the labor markets, for example. How well is the economy able to do this adaptation based on market forces? Here's an example from a period of so-called Walker period. Paul Walker was a really, really active central bank governor at the beginning of 1980s. And when he was nominated to the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the US economy was experiencing really, really high level of inflation. And his mission was to start a strong fight against inflation. So basically, the thing that he started to do was that he introduced steep changes in the Fed funds rates. So he introduced a monetary tightening period. that was really strong. And here's a sort of a final result. And you get an idea in the US case that how long does this take actually to sort of realize. So at the original point, there was this tightening of monetary policy. So here in the blue lines, we are in the original situation. Inflation is really high. Aggregate supply and aggregate demand are here, long run aggregate supply. So basically the US economy was experiencing a low, really high inflation with the long run aggregate supply curve position like this. So production basically was at the natural level or the potential level at that time. Monetary policy tightening in the form of really increasing interest rates. At the beginning of this, the Fed funds rate was around 18%. That is historically really, really high. And the hike was about 3 to 4% per quarters of a year. So it was really, really strong. Something that the US economy had never experienced before that. So it's a classical textbook example about the things that how can they really go, actually, like the theory says. So it lowered the output because incentive to do more real investments of the firm sector especially suffered. And also the net exports of the economy also suffered of that quite a lot. So it lowered the output to the level of Y2 here. And inflation also lowered, and it shifted now the aggregate supply curve based on our previous ideas that we have already been discussing downwards. And it actually, the economy ended finally to a situation where the output increased back to the potential output level, but inflation declined to a more or less the target level at that time. He originally issued a 4% target for the inflation, but was able to actually succeed even better. And it took something like 6 years. So you experienced a period of higher unemployment. So referring to this slack or the decrease in the production. So you experienced a 3 years or 2 years period of about 3% higher unemployment rates in 82 and 83. But after that, now the production started to recover, unemployment rates started to decrease, you were able to actually reach the final inflation target. So he was able to sort of reduce the potential level of inflation to clearly lower level than where it was originally. So this is a textbook example of efficient monetary policy in terms of having an effect on the real economic cycles. In the US economy, we actually have not experienced nothing like this after that in terms of the efficiency of the monetary policy actions. But in that time, it was actually something that actually it had, happens to be that John Taylor actually used this part of his data series that he used for the estimations of the Taylor rule actually were covering this period. So there was a nice connection between the Fed funds rate and the real economic activity and inflation actually during this period. So, but after that, when you are at the really low levels of inflation and really low levels of interest rate, it's actually not something, it's not working so well. But he was able to get to this this thing. Then another thing as an example from the US economy once again, this is from the period of the IT bubble. At the beginning of 2000 or this millennium, in the US economy and also in the other markets, global markets, we experienced this IT bubble related to the development of the stock valuation, especially in the IT sector, not so much in the other sectors of the stock markets. So there was actually a bubble in the markets, and it pricked. For some reason or other, the investors sort of lost their confidence on the future development of this specific sector in terms of the stock market valuation. So it actually had also a effect on the these relevant things in the aggregate demand, because they affect it affected to the prospects about the future. So suddenly they get more or less collapsed due to the breaking of this IT bubble. So it had an effect on the declining, in the form of declining autonomous consumption and investment. Future prospects declined. So by definition, they are included to the autonomous components of consumption and real investments, both declined. So it had an effect on the aggregate demand. And it also introduced an increase in that F factor that also has a role to play in the real investments. The funds frictions increased. Market participants more or less lost their trust in the future. And it all these together had an effect on the aggregate demand curve. So original point was once again here, these blue lines. And the next step was a change in the aggregate demand. It shifted downwards. And it decreased output and inflation. So we were able to get to this point. Actually, aggregate supply in short term didn't change anything. So we are here in the second step here at the intersection of aggregate supply and new aggregate demand curve. And it had an effect on the output and inflation, both decreased, and it started to feed up to the aggregate supply. It changed the position of aggregate supply downwards, and the economy returned back to the long run equilibrium with inflation permanently lower. So basically, it can be the case that without any actions, the economy can return to a new level of equilibrium values for inflation and production. If the original shock has basically nothing to do with the real economic activity prospects. Obviously, you understand that the breaking of a bubble in somewhere in one individual stock market sector that basically perhaps doesn't have so much to do with industrial productions and so on. So it has been developing based on irrational exuberance, more or less. It should not actually have, at least in a bit longer terms, like here in the 5 years period of time, it should not actually have pretty much any effect on the real economic activity. Well, it increased unemployment rate, but there are lots of other things also going on there where the unemployment rate was reacting, but inflation stayed pretty much at the same level. It came lower for a period of while, but then became original values that they were in connection to their starting point. Okay, so basically the aggregate supply curve can shift from temporary supply price shocks in which the long-run aggregate supply curve does not shift, or from a permanent supply shocks in which the long-run aggregate supply curve actually does shift. We are in the overtime already, so let's continue from these last slides next week and try to get to the point where I can give you the ideas about the requirements for the exam. Okay, thanks. See you next week. Oh, no. See you tomorrow. You have to go to Jari Mikko's second lecture also. Thanks.